This is The Guardian.
Today, why so many autistic women have to fight for recognition. For Carly Jones, life has always come with some added complications.
Social imagination, that's the most difficult for me. If I say something, somebody says something else, what happens next? Kind of foreseeing social consequences. I can't get across, importantly enough, just how difficult that is to live like that.
She struggled with school, friends, and the outside world.
I'm incredibly sensitive to light. Lights can be incredibly difficult for me. They can make me go non-verbal.
And sometimes she could be in harmful physical pain without even realising.
When I was 14, I had appendicitis and didn't know until it basically needed to be taken out as an emergency surgery.
Then, at 32, she was diagnosed as autistic and everything began falling into place. But because she was a woman, the world still didn't quite believe her.
If I had a pound for every time somebody said to me, oh, but you don't look autistic, I'd be a millionaire by now.
Last week, TV presenter Melanie Sykes and the model Christine McGuinness both revealed that they were autistic. And that, just like Carly, they weren't diagnosed until well into adulthood.
I just think it's going to help so many other women, either if they are already autistic and don't talk about it, come out, or if they were suspecting to look towards a diagnosis and look towards support.
But the delays in being diagnosed that Melanie, Christine and Carly had to endure are a problem for thousands more like them. So what does autism look like for women and girls? And why do we find it so hard to recognise? From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, the autistic women denied a diagnosis for decades. Carly, you were diagnosed at 32, so you grew up not knowing that you were autistic. Can you tell me what your childhood was like?
Very difficult. Very difficult. Many challenges at school. You know what, it's as early as kind of about 3 or 4. My poor mum, she would walk home from dropping me off and she said, you know, by the time she'd got into the street, she could hear the landline ringing in the house and she didn't even go home. She just walked straight back. She knew it was the nursery. Bless her heart, she actually ended up getting a job. She was an accountant, kind of gave that up and ended up working at the nursery and then worked at the primary school that I was at because I had the same problem there. And when I got to secondary school, she was like, you're on your own.
So, do you remember how other kids and teachers treated you back then?
Well, for me, when I'm not giving eye contact, I find eye contact quite painful. It makes me incredibly anxious. I've got bad eyesight. So, I mean, I've got contact lenses in today, but I'll take my glasses off and I can't see anything but a little cloud when I've got my glasses off. So that's my way of coping with it. But or at school, I'd kind of have my hoodie up and my head down on the desk, which was probably seen as somebody that's lazy. And that was what I was called a lot of the time, as lazy. And that's very hurtful because I work really hard. You know, if I'm not looking at someone when they're talking to me, it means I'm incredibly interested and I'm being really respectful because I'm normally directing my ear in their direction rather than my eyes, because we don't really hear with our eyes, apparently. So we hear with our ears. So that got me into a lot of trouble. And doodling. Oh, I doodle all the time and still do now on Zoom calls at work. And that's, for me, what we call a stim. It's the way of moving your body. I used to try and wear sunglasses a lot, even in December, because of bright lights and, you know, you get people saying, oh, who do you think you are? Do you think you're famous or something? And you think you're a rock star because you always got your glasses on. And that obviously was from young people, but from teachers, that could be misunderstood as well.
How did you find schoolwork? Did you do well?
No, I didn't do well at all, schoolwork. Poetry, I did well in, and acting. But yeah, drama, I used to get all the awards in the drama each year, but I left school 15. I was pregnant and pretty much asked not to come back because I'd be a bad role model. No GCSEs. I lived in a homeless hostel for young mums.
To be clear, the school said to you that they didn't want you to come back and you weren't allowed to come back?
Well, I heard through my parents, they didn't ever speak to me directly, but that was the gist of it, that I would be a bad role model because I was starting to show, I was getting a bump. It wouldn't be acceptable for the other girls to see someone pregnant. And yeah, so then we didn't have proms then, but we kind of had the end of school parties, and I really wanted to go. Although I'm not really big on parties, it was just, you know, everyone else was doing it, and it was an absolute outright no, you can't come. It's just awful, really. So it's been nice having my girls and seeing them do nice things. But it was horrible, really.
And Carly, as you said, you now have three daughters, and two of them were diagnosed with autism.
Yeah.
Was it difficult to get their diagnosis?
Do you know what? No, it wasn't. And
okay.
I don't really like telling parents that now, because the good thing about the amount of awareness is that loads more people are aware. Girls are getting their diagnosis much sooner. We're much safer after diagnosis. And we can safeguard ourselves much better. So that's a good thing. But the waiting lists now are kind of 3 or 4 years in length. But my waiting time for their diagnosis was 12 weeks. That's kind of 2008. Right. And 2010 wasn't very long at all. And the doctors were fab and diagnosed incredibly quickly. It was kind of in the wider world, you know. I can remember taking my daughters to school and being taken aside by a head teacher, and they took me into the office and said, you know, autism only happens to boys. You know, you profess to have two autistic girls, basically calling me a liar. And that was really painful.
A head teacher said that?
Yeah.
How did you respond?
Cried. Well, not in front of them, because I wanted to be tough. I got into the car and cried. In another school, one of my daughters, I picked her up from school, and, you know, we'd moved to this area to get into this catchment area for this, you know, best free to go to school. It's kind of lots of mums in Range Rovers and Barber coats, and I turn up in a neon Ford KA wearing a luminous green velour tracksuit. I just, it was quite funny. Actually, one of my daughter's friends said, "Oh, why on earth is your nanny dressed like a leprechaun?" I thought, first of all, I'm not the au pair, I'm a mum. Second of all, velour is in. Anyway, so I kind of picked her up from school, and she had, it was red, it was like a red bit of card stapled round the back. It looks basically looked like a dunce hat. And it had written on it, "I will be polite to everyone I meet." And it was on my daughter's head, who was 6 years old, came out of school. And I said to the head teacher, "What is on my daughter's head?" And they said, "Oh, it's our way, you know, of basically breaking them into their mould, if you like. And she's not looking at people when they talk to her. She's been incredibly rude, of course."
Oh,
and
wow.
She had to wear that hat for an entire school day, including break times and lunch times. And she never went back to that school. Now, obviously, we're talking kind of, what's that, 12, 13 years ago now, so things have moved on dramatically. But I think people forget just what it was like, even going back, you know, not even 20 years ago, going back, what it was like for autistic girls in the classroom. But that is what it was like.
Hannah Devlin, you're the Guardian science correspondent, and you've written about the subject quite a bit before. So I just want to ask you, girls with autism are often misdiagnosed or diagnosed later, if they are at all. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so I think there's a few different things going on here. I guess one issue has been, historically, it's been thought of as a male condition. And that's meant that a lot of the studies into autism have exclusively focused on boys and men, just excluded females from studies because it's just been seen as introducing unnecessary noise into the data almost. But there has been a shift over time, and there has been an increase in the proportion of females diagnosed with autism over the past 20 years. In 1998, in England, 18% of the newly diagnosed cases were female. And then by 2018, that had gone up to 23%, so it's gone up a bit less than one in four. And then when you go out and actively screen people, potentially, you know, took 1,000 children and screened them all to see just how many meet the diagnostic criteria, it's about 1 in 3 that are girls and women that would meet the criteria.
So in other words, if you take a section of society and screen them all to see who meets the criteria, of those people who do, it might be as high as 1 in 3 who are female. Do you think that number could change?
some people feel that that could go, that ratio could come down even further if the diagnostic criteria were balanced to reflect the way autism might appear slightly different or subtly different in girls and women. So because a lot of the studies of autism are focused on boys and men, it might be sort of skewing the diagnostic criteria a little bit towards the way it presents in males.
And so for people who are trying to understand it a bit better, can you explain why it's generally understood to be on a spectrum?
Yeah, so again, this is something that has changed a bit over time. In the past, there was a related condition called Asperger's syndrome, which was essentially taken to be a kind of high functioning autism where people had language and didn't have any intellectual cognitive impairments. Mm. But a few years ago, that diagnosis was sort of taken out of the manual and replaced by autism spectrum disorder. And the idea is that there is a spectrum of how extreme these traits are.
One reason that's given for why the condition in girls isn't picked up is because of masking. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so this is something that has started to kind of emerge in the more recent studies where people have gone out and really tried to study autism in girls and women and try and understand that a bit better. And it does appear that girls and women are perhaps, you know, mimicking body language, the kinds of subjects that people might choose to talk about. It's not completely clear whether this is something that girls and women with autism are better at doing, they're more adept at doing it, or whether it's something that has arisen through a greater social pressure to fit in, and a sort of, you know, more pressure on girls and women to sort of fit the mould. And that may, you know, superficially you may think, oh, well, that must make things easier. But actually, you know, anecdotally, some of the people I've spoken to say it can take a huge toll on mental health and it can affect your self-esteem and, you know, sense of yourself, really. And there's some research coming through now to tentatively back that up, that there may be potentially worse mental health problems linked to autism in girls and women, which is obviously something that, you know, sort of needs more attention and needs to be looked at.
After getting a diagnosis for two of her daughters, Carly started looking back at her own struggles in a whole new light.
So once the girls were diagnosed, all these things started to make sense, and I went for an NHS diagnosis at 27, 28, something like that. And I said, what are your hobbies? And I said, I love acting. And of course I love acting. It's the only time in life where I know what happens next.
Right.
Real life is like a performance which everyone else in the world got a script for, and no one decided to add me in the memo. He said, oh, well, if you like acting, you can't be autistic, because you'd have to put yourself in someone else's shoes. And I said, well, I don't. I let someone else walk in my shoes for a little bit. Anyway, so I didn't get that diagnosis and carried on making films and doing my advocacy. And thank goodness for the National Autistic Society, who had obviously seen some of the stuff I was putting out, and they emailed me and said, we'd like you to come to a conference. And I was fortunate that in the front row of that talk was a hero of mine, a lady called Dr. Judith Gould, who actually in 1981 coined the term Asperger's, which is my official diagnosis, although we don't use the term Asperger's anymore. We just say autism. So I sent an email to Dr. Gould, and she invited me in. And after a few meetings, I was diagnosed by her, which is just such a privilege. And I filmed it, actually. It's online free for people to watch if they want.
Oh, hello. Come in.
It's called Epidemic of Knowledge.
Tell me about eye contact.
I filmed my own diagnosis, and that went off to Cannes Film Festival in 2015.
But that
I can't
relax,
see
then.
Anything right now.
All right, yeah.
I can just see my hand there.
So your way, that's a way then of actually switching off and being able to say, I'm not really making eye contact now, even though you're looking at me.
Yeah.
So it's been a long and, I guess, non-traditional way of getting diagnosed.
Yeah.
But how did it feel once you had something to call this thing that you'd been dealing with your whole life?
On a personal note, it was the biggest relief I've ever had. I sent a bunch of flowers to Dr. Gould the day after, and on the card it said, thank you for the first day of the rest of my life, and she saved my life. And there's no two ways about that. I'd shudder to think what my life would be like now without Dr. Gould. So the first thought is that of utter gratitude, relief, lots of tears. It makes me quite emotional to think about it now. And then you get, as a parent of autistic girls, you have this second wave, which is complete fear, thinking, wow, if all of those negative life experiences, of which there are tens of thousands, if all of those were because of the fact that I'm autistic and the fact that I can't foresee what might happen next, if that is because of this thing called autism, and I also have autistic girls, you know, the cycle stops here. And it was a, excuse my language, a kick up the backside to go, right, you've got to go out there and change as much as you can in order for it to be better for them and other girls like them. And I've been on a bit of a a bit of a crusade since.
Well, do you want to tell me a bit more about your work? Because you've become an advocate for other women now. And what does that mean for the women you give support to?
It can mean all sorts of different things. It could be anything from that kind of one-to-one support. I often get kind of domestic abuse charities emailing me saying, we need you to speak to one of the women that are in one of their safe houses. They're autistic. A lot of the time it can be people that are going through family law or legal court cases, because that's very difficult for autistic people, male or female, young or old. In kind of that situation. So it could be anything like that, to then accessibility, making sure that airports, for example, railways are accessible for autistic passengers. And then it could go up to, you know, working things like the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice for making sure that we're getting talent, autistic talent in the highest places. So it's really broad, really, really broad. It could be something different every day.
What's the most significant thing that you'd want to draw attention to that would change the lives of autistic women?
Oh, safeguarding. So much to be done with safeguarding. We need health professionals. We need the judicial system. We need, particularly for young mums and for older women as well, safeguarding is a huge, huge one. And in the court system as well, we need autistic women better understood. I know women that have lost their children by being asked the wrong questions and almost being tripped into answering the way that would go negatively against them. And I've seen it in my own eyes. And that needs to change dramatically and fast.
Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so I've been in court with women as an advocate. I'm not allowed to talk in court. I'm allowed to write to the judge beforehand. I'm allowed to be there as a support system and kind of give recommendations of how to ask questions and stuff. But yeah, there was one woman, and she was asked, you know, you've been on a parenting course. What was the best thing you got out of it? And then mentioned all the best things she got out of it, like meeting other people, not feeling so isolated, which was kind of put down as mum has no concept of child's needs before her own. But that's the wrong question. They should have asked her, so you've been on a parenting course. What's the best parenting strategies you learnt on the parenting course? Very explicit. And she would have gone, oh, well, I've learnt to do this, that, blah, blah, blah. And reeled off a whole list of things. But they didn't ask her that. They asked the best thing she got out of it. And she answered very honestly and very literally, which autistic people do. And it went against her, and I'm furious still.
So the consequences of being misunderstood can be devastating for these women. And it just made me think back to the fact that you mentioned that teacher saying that women or girls can't be autistic.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know what are the other myths that you come across that really frustrate you? What would you like to set the record straight on?
Oh, wow. So many myths out there. So, yes, one is that autism only happens to boys. Obviously, that's incorrect. Vaccinations, that one gets my go. Oh, I feel like I've got a list coming on. I'm enjoying this. So if people say, oh, you know, vaccinations cause autism. They don't, never have, never will. That one's very annoying. On a more personal note, people might... Someone asked me if autistic people like sex once, and which I thought was really silly. And everyone's a little bit autistic. That one annoys me as well. It's hard. I think sometimes people might say it in a well-intentioned way to make autistic people feel better, but what it actually does is devalue our life experiences and our daily struggles. I find that very, very hard to hear. I might get sent scripts, be that from the BBC, or I might get sent articles that are about to be out for publication, and someone will say, look, can you read through this and tell me if anything I'm saying is offensive? And people will often say, and if you've said this, don't feel bad, because everyone says it. So somebody might say, oh, here is a person with autism. So many autistic people prefer, here is an autistic person, okay? Because with autism, it kind of feels like it's our suitcase that we can choose to leave at home. They're all far worse ones, though. The worst ones are, Carly lives with autism. If I live with autism, he can start paying towards the mortgage. Right. Or is touched by autism. He needs a restraining order. Or suffers from autism. That's the worst one. So yeah, sometimes things like that can be a bit annoying. But we've got bigger fish to fry, unfortunately. Although they are annoying, there's bigger fish to fry. I think the best thing is, autistic people, we love being a student or a teacher in a situation. So if you've got a question, just ask. And most people won't be offended. So just if you've got an autistic family member or friend, just ask them. We won't mind.
Coming up, what it meant to Carly when she was awarded an MBE. Carly, you've obviously had an extraordinary life and an incredibly rewarding one too. But you've also talked about how much tougher it makes things for women and girls not to be diagnosed. Can you think of examples of how getting that diagnosis would have made things different for you?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. I mean, there's two waves of thought. There's so many things. If I'd known I was autistic as a child, my life would look very different now. And in some ways, I wouldn't change that. But in many, many, many ways, I would. Incredibly vulnerable friendships, relationships. I feel frustrated that I kind of left school without any GCSEs. And because I'm not stupid, I just couldn't flourish in a mainstream school. And that's the biggest regret I have. That's tough as an adult as well, and particularly as a divorced mum, and you're the sole breadwinner and you haven't got any qualifications and you just have to do everything, from scratch. I wish I'd known, from a safeguarding point of view, from a self-esteem point of view, you know you're different. And sometimes parents will say to me that, they don't want to label their child with the autism diagnosis. But, there are so many other more unkind labels out there, autism being the kindest label. And it's just really challenging. And you just feel like a bit of a failure, second-class human. And once you've got your diagnosis, you understand, actually, this is why I find certain things difficult. And it gives you a sense of self-forgiveness as well.
And I wonder now, like with your daughters having grown up, and when you think about their lives and the fact that they were diagnosed early, are you hopeful that makes it easier for them to navigate the world than it was for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, one of my daughters, who's 19, she's now uni doing forensic psychology, and incredibly proud of her. They're all doing great. And that's the biggest joy, to be able to look at them and go, they've got it better. And when I get feedback from parents saying, you supported my daughter however many years ago, and parents will get back in touch with me and say they're now doing this, or they're getting married, or they've just finished uni, and or they're not having to use mental health services anymore and things like that. And I think that's the biggest badge of honour, because you just know that they're letting you know that because of you this happened, and that's the best emails I ever get. Because there are lots of sad...
That's a really wonderful, satisfying thing.
There are lots of sad emails as well, unfortunately, which is the worst part of the job. When, you know, some people, we do lose some young girls and take their own lives. And so those emails never get easier. But there are also those nice emails that come through.
In 2018, you received an MBE for your work on behalf of autistic women and girls. And that moment must really made you think how far you've come. And I bet that it was actually also quite satisfying to stick two fingers up at the mums in their Range Rovers who thought you were an au pair dressed as a leprechaun as well. But how has that been for you, that experience and that even happening? And how does it propel you forward?
I remember getting the letter. I think it was 24th of November 2017. Not that I'm autistic and I remember dates. It was 2:30 in the afternoon. And I was eating a cheese sandwich. And I couldn't finish my cheese sandwich because I was crying. It was this kind of cry I'd never heard before. So naturally, I had a moment of being very personally proud, but the real tears came when I was allowed to tell people and having some of the girls I've supported get in touch. One girl drew me a congratulations card, and she drew a picture of autistic girls, are kind of like in like super girl type clothes, and that for me was the biggest one. It's very important that people that help autistic people are recognised. That's very important. But actually, for the young women and older women I support, to see an autistic woman just like them, to be able to be recognised in that way, and it just helps them know that they're absolutely limitless, and it doesn't matter if you fell out of school, pregnant 15, no GCSEs. It doesn't matter what life's kind of thrown at you. You're limitless. Life will never go to plan. And so, do you know what? If you can't foresee consequences, maybe that's a good thing, because plans tend to not work, but your purpose never changes. So if you just stick with your purpose, whatever life throws at you, you're always going to be all right, because you're just sticking to your purpose.
Well, that's solid life advice for anyone, autistic or not, I think. Stick to your purpose. Carly, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
That was Carly Jones. My thanks to her and to Hannah Devlin. You can read Hannah's piece, We Weren't Visible, Growing Awareness Leads More Women to Autism Diagnosis, at theguardian.com. And you can pre-order Carly's book, Safeguarding Autistic Girls, Strategies for Professionals, which is out in December. If you have been affected by any of the issues we've discussed in this podcast, you can contact Samaritans by calling 116 123 or emailing joe@samaritans.org. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Thanks as well to Alistair McGregor. Sound design is by Rudy Zagadlo. And the executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.